books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, winner of the 2024 Booker Prize, Samantha Harvey, and I listen to her book, Orbital. Plus, we'll find some brand new audiobooks out now and also available in the RNIB Talking Books library. That's all coming up on today's Read On. For over 10 years, RNIB and the Booker Foundation have worked together to make sure all of the books on the shortlist are available in audio and braille for blind and partially sighted readers. At a clustering ceremony, the winner of this year's prize was revealed to be Samantha Harvey. We'll hear from them in a moment, but first there's a clip of the winning title.
Orbit 1 into Orbit 2. You aren't even the farthest flung humans now, says Ground Control. How does that feel? For today, a crew of four is on its way to the moon, and has just surpassed the space station's shallow orbiting distance of 250 miles above the planet. The lunar astronauts are catapulted past them in a $5 billion blaze of suited, booted glory. For the first time ever, you've been overtaken, says Ground Crews. You're yesterday's news, they joke. And Pietro jokes back that better yesterday's news than tomorrow's, if they know what he means. If you're an astronaut, you'd rather not ever be news. And here's the thing, thinks Chie. Her mother's down there, on that Earth. Everything that's left of her mother's down there. Better to be lassoing it like this than watching it disappear in the rearview mirror. Anton just looks out of the space viewing portal to where he knows the constellations of Pegasus and Andromeda to be. Though, his vision can't readily sift them out among the millions of stars. He's tired. Doesn't sleep that well up here, mind too constantly jet-lagged and staggered. There's Saturn. There's the aeroplane shape of Aquila. The moon's a stone's throw. One day, he thinks, he'll get there.
So the book is set over one 24-hour period in low Earth orbit. The book is set on a space station, which is essentially the ISS, although it's never called that in the book. And there are four astronauts, two cosmonauts on the space station. And it follows them over one day orbiting the Earth. So 16 sunsets and 16 sunrises, 16 transits of the Earth. And it's really a day in the life on the space station, and it's very much a book, I mean, first and foremost, I think, a book about the Earth and the perspective that we have on the Earth from the distance of low Earth orbit.
With 16 orbits a day, the human body's kind of designed to be regulated by the sunset and the sunrise. That must really, the concept of time must be really hard to get when you're up in the space station.
Yeah, imagine so. The books that I've read by astronauts talk about time quite a lot, obviously. And, you know, this, we're so on Earth, so tethered to our circadian rhythms and the 24-hour clock. In space, it doesn't really hold. I mean, the space stations and the ground crews do their best to try to keep that rhythm of a 24-hour day. And everything is scheduled and they are on essentially Greenwich Mean Time. So they do their best to try to make it feel normal, but it's never going to feel normal, is it, when you're going around the Earth every 90 minutes? And that was one of the things I really wanted to try to encode into the book, into the structure of the book. So that's why I set it over one day, so that we have one 24-hour period. But that time period, as we know it, is exploded. And maybe the structure of the book being told through chapters which are numbered orbits might help to simulate perhaps for the reader a sense of the dislocation of that experience of time, which I imagine and can only imagine the astronauts and cosmonauts up there feel.
Yeah, you said can only imagine. A lot of authors will visit the place where their novel's set, but this might be a bit out of reach. But what was your research process?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would have loved to have gone there and been able to research from there, but I don't think most research grants don't stretch to that. So my research was mainly desk bound. I read a lot of books by astronauts. I read journals and diaries that astronauts have kept. There's a lot on the NASA website and the ESA, the European Space Agency website. You can sort of borrow quite deep into those sites and find quite a lot of archived material, really interesting stuff about daily life on the ISS. And there is, you know, there is so much information out there about the ISS. It's actually very easy to research. It's sort of knowing how to use that research and where to stop and when to let your imagination take hold. And I think that for me, the single biggest and most helpful element of my research was looking at images of the Earth from space. So it's a very visual book. I think it's I wanted it to feel as much like a painting as it is a novel. And I had on my desktop almost continually for the whole time of writing this book, you know, two and a half years or so, footage of the Earth from space. And I would make endless transits around the Earth, albeit from my desk, and try to describe what I saw. So that was my most direct form of inspiration and research. But then that was obviously augmented with written documents by astronauts and listening to interviews with astronauts and so on.
I've got a couple of monitors here, and one of them is the live feed from the ISS. So they're over Japan right now.
Oh, it's just magical, isn't it? And it, interestingly, that live feed doesn't work very often. Well, they might have improved it. When I was researching the book, it often wouldn't be working. But when it is working, it's just so, it's so magnificent to be able to see what they can see. Oh, it's really, you know, the technology behind that and the accessibility of it, I think, is really wonderful.
You kind of alluded to this in the last answer, but would you go up on the ISS?
Well, it depends. It depends on the day that I'm asked. Today, yeah, maybe I would.
Or even one of those, you know, like the Jeff Bezos flights where you kind of touch space.
Yeah, I think that would be worth doing. I mean, I am a really, really unadventurous person, so you know, it's easy for me to sit here and I'll say, yeah, why not? I think if it came to it, I'd probably be too cowardly to do it. I mean, it is a safe way of traveling in that, you know, astronauts and cosmonauts are going up and down there all the time. It's almost like a coach excursion to them. But it is, you know, it has many inherent dangers and it is very rough on the body. So would I? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I kind of take comfort in the fact that I probably never have to make this decision, so I can safely say now, yeah, sure.
There, in that emptiness, the typhoon is organising. For the last 24 hours, it's been shifting west. By now, past the Marshall Islands, that fragile tracery of sinking land so piecemeal and storm-worn. First some clumping of high-drifting cloud, the clouds congregating from all directions, denser and darker. Not one storm, but a collision of several, and it's clear now that the cloud is muscling and spiraling into what could be, at the very least, a Category 4 typhoon. Take as many photographs as you can, the crew is told, and they do, their long lenses against the glass shutter stuttering, seeing only the eastern arm of the storm so far, off to starboard where it wraps itself against the Earth's horizon in flocks of spun grey, seeing in detail what nobody on Earth can see, how the clouds are ordering themselves anti-clockwise, a whipped-up rowdy march.
Now, almost everyone who's been lucky enough or rich enough to reach space or the edge of space has come back with a sense of awe and protection. Is that what you're trying to pass on to the reader?
I think that's exactly it. Yeah. I wanted to write a book that felt joyous and that could So revel in a sense of beauty and awe and rapture without anything having to go wrong. So I wanted to see if I could write a narrative, a novel that didn't have some kind of conflict at the heart of it, which is, you know, conflict in novels and films and so on is, you know, usually the driver of drama that, and, you know, that's what makes stuff happen. And I thought, well, would it be to just write something that was about a kind of a suspended, in, you know, in every sense, a suspended reality that was trying to rest in a place of wonder, and to see if I can pull that off, and to see if I can do with words what the images of the space do to me when I see them, and to try to use words in a painterly way. And I suppose this is maybe pertinent to your listeners and to people who cannot see those images, you know, and is there a way of being able to get to the richness of them and the rapture of those images, but with words? That seemed to me really interesting proposition. So yeah, I wanted it very much to be a book that was about joy and about beauty.
It's quite a claustrophobic setting on the space station, a very finite space, but it is in the middle of infinity.
It's a funny dissonance, isn't it? And I think that when I was researching this book, I found so many dissonances like that, that yeah, they are an incredibly claustrophobic space. And also when they look out, there's nothing there. There's nobody there. I mean, there's the earth below, of course, but all of humanity is there. They can't get to it. So you have this kind of claustrophobia, agoraphobia at once. You have the sense, at least as I could appreciate it from my, you know, just looking at videos, the sense of the earth being so huge and yet so very, very small and intimate and familiar and almost a domestic, you know, that because they're only 250 miles above it. So there's that sort of dissonance as well. And I think it's a really interesting clash of things, of perspectives and experience that you get there. The fact that, you know, they're in this, they're at a vantage point where, you know, every day is sort of strange and magnificent and extraordinary and unlike anything we can experience on Earth. But at the same time, they have to do a lot of dusting and a lot of vacuuming and just a lot of housewares, a lot of housekeeping on the ISS. I was really interested in that too, you know, the domesticity of that setting, the fact that we, you know, we live there as a species. We live there in a very sort of mundane and domestic way. But there's nothing mundane about where it is and the perspective it affords. So that, I think, was a really interesting clash of perspective and experience I wanted to, you know, try to explore.
Russian cosmonauts only, it says on the door of the Russian WC. Correspondingly, on the US toilet door, American, European and Japanese astronauts only. Because of ongoing political disputes, please use your own national toilet. The idea of a national toilet has caused some amusement among the crew. I'm just going to take a national pee, Sean will say. Or Roman, guys, I'm going to go and do one for Russia. You will have to now pay us to use our toilet facilities, the Russian Space Agency has said to those of America, Europe, and Japan. And so those agencies have responded in kind. Go right ahead. Our toilet is in any case better than yours. And neither can you use our exercise bike. Well, you can't access our food stores then. It's been like this now for over a year. On the craft's internal cameras, Mission Control watches the crew in flagrant disregard of these edicts, and there's no point trying to make it different. Astronauts and cosmonauts are much like cats, they conclude. Intrepid, cool, and can't be herded.
There's little quirks as well up there, because like the example I'm thinking of is you're only allowed to use your own national toilet.
Yeah, and that's not the usual setup there. And as far as I know, that's not what's happening there now. But I did read somewhere that a few years ago there had been some sort of dispute on Earth, obviously, between the US and Russia. This is before the war in Ukraine. And as a result, you know, I think the American Well, I think maybe the Russian space agency Roscosmos had said to the Americans, okay, well, because of this dispute, you can't use our toilet. So there are different capsules on the ISS, and the Russian module, the one set of modules have their own toilet, and it's quite different to the US one, and you have to do a different training course to use it and so on. So they said the Americans and the Europeans and the Japanese astronauts couldn't use their toilet, and so the Americans said, okay, fine, well, you can't use our toilet. And it's sort of amusing and sort of incredibly senseless when you think about where they are. And because while I was writing this novel, the war in Ukraine broke out, I wanted to somehow point to the fact that the novel was aware of the current state of affairs on the earth, but I didn't really want to write about it overtly. So I thought, okay, I'll just make that allusion to that conflict on earth by mentioning the toilets.
We'll have more from Samantha Harvey in a moment, but now let's take our first trip to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. HarperCollins recently gave us Into the Storm by best-selling author Cecilia Ahern.
The rain against the windshield is relentless. It buckets down from the heavens as if somebody or something is angrily and deliberately attempting to wipe them all out, like a demonic toddler with a watering can over an anthole. And you can't see a thing beyond the violent movements of her windshield wipers and the blurry slurry of rain, which is making outside seem like a mirage or melting hot wax. Everything dripping, dissolving, and slowly becoming undone.
It is a wild night in the middle of December, and GP Enya is crouched over a teenage boy performing CPR in the rain. One moment the boy survives, but Enya's life splinters in two. Trapped in a loveless marriage, the storm propels her to break free. But even in the remote country town that becomes her sanctuary, Enya is haunted by the night in the rain. Beneath the boughs of an ancient tree that tells a thousand stories, can she find the courage to face her own?
She takes her foot off the accelerator as she whips around another corner she didn't see coming. Her stomach heaves at the sudden lurch and her heart pounds. Her shoulders are tense as she grips the wheel for dear life, and her jaw aches as she clamps down her teeth. She slides around the narrow winding roads through the Cruag and Kilmashogue Mountains, lined with stone walls and conifer forest. The slopes are rugged, scattered with granite boulders transported during the Ice Age and dropped erratically, none of which she can see on this darkest of dark nights and the shortest of days, but she knows it's there. She grew up in this neck of the woods, the Dublin Mountains, and homeschooled by her mother, there was no classrooms but fields of lessons. Education was something you touched, tasted, smelled, felt. Even with her knowledge of the roads, she knows she should stop, pull in and wait for the rainstorm to subside. Surely the rain can't keep up like this for much longer. Her headlights occasionally take a snapshot of rapidly racing water down the roadside, running away like a mischief of rats. Ireland will disappear, fade away as if none of them were ever there. A small island in the Atlantic Ocean, finally so saturated it plunges to the ocean floor to lie like a deep water sponge.
Into the Storm by Cecilia Ahern is read by Angeline Ball and runs for 10 hours and 50 minutes.
Penguin Random House recently gave us a new collection of short stories by Lee Child. It's called Safe Enough and Other Stories.
Like everything else, the world of bodyguarding is split between the real and the phony. Phony bodyguards are just glorified drivers, big men in suits chosen for their size and shape and appearance, not paid very much, not very useful when push comes to shove. Real bodyguards are technicians, thinkers, trained men with experience. They can be small, as long as they can think and endure. As long as they can be useful when the time comes. I'm a real bodyguard. Or at least, I was.
From the world's number one thriller writer comes 20 pulse-pounding short stories. A drug-dealing hitman unburdens his fears to a stranger. An overlooked rookie cop is assigned to the department's file room. A ruthless killer only kills bad guys. A methodical bodyguard quits his job when he is outsmarted. A military mission is planned to perfection. Meticulously plotted and utterly compelling, these are intimate portraits of humanity at its best and worst. Each story is entirely distinct, and with their economical prose and unexpected twists, each could only have been written by the creator of Jack Reacher.
I was trained in one of those secret army regiments where close personal protection is part of the curriculum. I plied that trade among many others for a long time, all over the world. I am a medium-sized man, lean, fast, full of stamina. Not quite a marathon runner, but nothing like a weightlifter. I left the army after 15 years of service and took jobs through an agency run by a friend. Most of the work was in South or Central America. Most of the engagements were short. I got into it right when the business was going crazy. Kidnapping for ransom was becoming a national sport in most of the South American nations. If you were rich or politically connected, you were automatically a target. I worked for British and American corporate clients. They had managers and executives in places like Panama and Brazil and Colombia. Those people were considered infinitely rich and infinitely connected. Rich because their employers were likely to bail them out, and those corporations were capitalized in the hundreds of billions. Connected because ultimately the Western governments would get involved. There was no greater sense of connection than a bad guy knowing he could sit in a jungle clearing somewhere and be heard in 10 Downing Street or the White House. But I never lost a client. I was a good technician, and I had good clients. All of them knew the stakes. They worked with me. They were biddable and obedient. They wanted to do their 2 years in the heat and get back alive to their head offices and their promotions. They kept their heads down, didn't go out at night, didn't really go anywhere except their offices and their job sites. All transport was at high speed in protected vehicles by varied routes and at unpredictable times. My clients never complained. Because they were working, they tended to accept a rough equivalent of military discipline. It was all relatively easy for a while. Then I went private. The money was better. The work was worse. I learned to stay away from people who wanted a bodyguard purely as a status symbol. There were plenty of those. They made me miserable because ultimately there wasn't much for me to do. Too many times I ended up running errands while my skills eroded. I learned to stay away from people who weren't in genuine need, too. London is a dangerous town and New York is worse, but nobody truly needs a bodyguard in either place. Again, not much to do. Boring and corrosive. I freely admit that my own risk addiction drove my decisions, including my decision to work for Anna.
Safe Enough by Lee Child is read by Richard Armitage and runs for 7 hours and 9 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor, and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. And now a return to the 2024 Booker winner, Samantha Harvey, and her book, Orbital. Please note this was recorded the day before Samantha won the Booker. The winning book, Orbital, is narrated by Sarah Naudi.
Where do the boundaries sit? Sean thinks as he moves past the window. He tries to place it all. Montenegro, Serbia, Hungary, Romania. He can never remember the exact arrangement. You could spend your days, your entire orbiting life, with your Rand McNally Atlas and your maps of the stars. You could do no work whatsoever. You could abandon it all, just to look. You could know the Earth inside out, in its little hollow of space. You could never really comprehend the stars, but the Earth, you could know in the way you know another person. In the way he came quite studiedly and determinedly to know his wife. With a yearning that's hungry and selfish, he wishes to know it, inch by inch.
Now, we've heard a clip of Sarah Naudi narrating Orbital. Did you have any hand in her casting?
I did, actually, yeah, a little bit, in that I was presented with a few possibilities. And everybody sounded very English, so very Radio 4. And I thought, this isn't right. You know, I don't want it to feel kind of like The Archers. I want it to feel a bit more international than that. So I asked for someone with a non-British accent and you know, sort of a vaguely international accent. And they came back with a couple of options. And I really liked Sarah's voice. So we decided to go with that.
Did you not fancy doing it yourself? Because you have narrated books before.
Yeah, I narrated my last book, which was non-fiction, and it was sort of memoir. So it made sense for me to narrate that book because it was about me. But actually, you know, narrating an audiobook is much more difficult than you think. I thought, well, you just go there and, you know, you read it and that's that. But there's a degree of acting involved. And I don't think I have the skills to, you know, other people could do that much more beautifully than I can. So I was quite happy to delegate that job.
There in his chest is a heart that tilts and pitches. He can keep its beat slow and smooth. Quell its habits of fear or panic or impulse. Stop it yearning too much for home. Curb its unhelpful states of abandon. Calm and steady. Calm and steady. Metronome pacing out the breath. Yet still at times it tilts and pitches. It wants what it wants, and hopes what it hopes, and needs what it needs, and loves what it loves.
Yeah, your last book was Shapeless Unease, A Year of Not Sleeping, which was a bit of a personal story. But do you think it would be easier to drift off to sleep in zero G?
Well, notoriously, it's very difficult to sleep in space, partly because your circadian rhythm is so completely shot that it's quite difficult for the body to know when it's day and when it's night. But also, you're bobbing about. Some of the astronauts, as far as I could tell, because they're just in a sleeping bag, you know, in their little crew quarters, which is like the size and sort of shape of a phone box, really. And so they're just kind of bobbing about in there in their sleeping bag. And some of them like to be tethered. They've got these sort of bungee cords and they tether themselves to the wall so that they can't, you know, just move around too much. And others really enjoy that feeling of being in water, being at sea. So I don't know because I've never experienced it, but it seems quite variable. I think sleep is something astronauts struggle with generally.
I have had Chris Hadfield on the show a couple of times, actually. And I did ask him about, did he take any books up and what was it like floating, reading a book? But he said, no, none of us have got any time to read.
Yeah, they're on a really punishing schedule. It's really, yeah, minute by minute every day. Yeah, I think that's right. I think they do watch films sometimes. But, and also you're allowed very few items in your sort of package that you can take up there. Books are quite heavy, I suppose. I mean, and I guess they could read them digitally. So yeah, there's that. But I don't know that there's a lot of reading happening up there.
If you went up, would you take some Danish licorice?
Of course, yeah. Especially if I were there for more than a week, then I would get licorice withdrawals and I would need it.
Now, Sarah Nowry narrates the audiobook. It's also available in Braille from RNIB. Is that important to you that it's available to anyone who doesn't have a relationship with print for whatever reason?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's, you know, fundamental to offer that. And when my publicist said that he wanted to do this interview and that the shortlist was being made accessible by the RNIB, I thought that was a wonderful thing. And maybe, you know, for all of the books and regardless of their subject, but, you know, for this book as well, because it's describing the visual world so much, and to me it's so much about trying to render the visual world in words, it feels very wonderful and important to me that should be made available. So yeah, I'm delighted about it. We are at the moment, my partner and I, being puppy raisers for the guide dogs for the blind. So we have quite a lot of awareness at the moment of training, not very well, training our puppy, you know, trying to be aware of that, the world of experience of blind people and partially sighted people. So this is something that's been very much on my mind for the last year. So I'm delighted about it. And I think it's incredibly important, completely fundamental that should be available.
Isn't it heartbreaking when you have to let your puppy go and it starts its professional life?
We haven't got there yet because she's our first puppy.
Right.
But yes, I can tell you in advance, yes, it will be heartbreaking. You get very, very attached. But we have to try and keep our eye on the prize and just hope that she makes it as a guide dog. They did warn us about that when we were being interviewed. You know, they said, you know, there is no option to keep the dog if there's no, we don't accept any bribes. You just have to hand the dog over and walk away. And at the time we were like, yeah, sure, that'll be okay. And now that's looking more and more difficult, but I think she's going to be going in January. So we have a couple more months.
If it's any consolation, I know two or three people, not all blind people have dogs by any means, but I know two or three people who do have dogs and they are life-changing.
Absolutely.
Really,
yeah, they are. And I think that's what, you know, knowing that helps to keep us focused, and knowing also that there's a real waiting list, there's a shortage of dogs at the moment. And there's been, you know, a lot of catching up from COVID when, you know, they couldn't get dogs to people. So we have to just try to keep our eye on that, but it's been a really amazing experience doing it, and we'll just have to get another puppy at some point.
Absolutely. Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Could you give us a little description of the cover of the book?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, when I saw this cover, I thought immediately, oh, this is the right cover for the book. I had, you know, before seeing it, I had no idea what the right cover would be. But when I saw it, I thought, oh, this is it. This is perfect. It's the first time I've felt that for any of my covers. It's black. And this is going to really show the limits of my spontaneous descriptive capacities. It's black and it has sort of blobs of color, sort of rather ethereal, blurred edged blobs of color on it, of blue and orange and green and pink. It has a small earth on it. It has some kind of wispy clouds. It looks spacey. It looks like it's going to be about space, but it also doesn't look sci-fi, which is exactly what I wanted because the book isn't sci-fi. It sort of looks like it could be the cover of a poetry edition almost, but it's beautiful, and it's both black and bright, which is very much how I envisage space. It's this, yes, it's black, but there's nothing sort of dull or flat or empty about it. It's got this brightness, this kind of singing brightness to it. And I think the cover captures that pretty well.
And it now also has a little sticker on it that is shortlisted for the Booker Prize 2024. How was that when you found out?
Oh, marvelous. Really, really overwhelming. When I found out I was on the long list, I was totally delighted. And I've been on the Booker long list before, but a long time ago. And so I thought, well, this is wonderful. If I could get to the shortlist, since I've never managed that, that will be enough. And that's career changing in its own way, and such wonderful validation. And it gives me everything I need at this point in my career. Because Orbital is my fifth novel, my sixth published book, so I've been going for a while. And then when I got on the shortlist, I thought, that's it. I've achieved, more than I could have hoped for, and I feel, it feels to me that it's without pressure. I don't feel any pressure to win. I don't expect I will win. I just feel this is exactly as far as I, this is enough. This is as far as I need to get in terms of my career. And it's just a wonderful, lovely honor. This, it doesn't have a downside so far.
That was recorded on Monday, the 11th of November. The very next day.
I am profoundly honoured to announce that the winner of the Booker Prize 2024 is Samantha Harvey for Orbital.
I would like to dedicate this prize, therefore, to everybody who does speak for and not against the Earth, for and not against the dignity of other humans, other life. And all the people who speak for and call for and work for peace, this is for you. Thank you.
From up here in space, where Roman glances out, passing through the dome of windows, the view is at first indistinct. It takes a moment to orientate. An expanse of wintry nothingness, pearly cloud cover, and then the familiar gleam of ice sheet sloping off the Antarctic Circle. Starboard, the Seven Sisters audaciously bright. Sometimes there are urges to see a particular thing, the pyramids, or the New Zealand fjords, or a desert of sand dunes that are bright orange and entirely abstract, and which the eyes can't fathom. The image could just as easily be a close-up of one of the heart cells they have in their Petri dishes. Sometimes they want to see the theatrics. The opera, the Earth's atmosphere, air glow, and sometimes it's the smallest things. The lights of fishing boats off the coast of Malaysia, dotted star-like in the black ocean. But now Roman can begin to see what he suspected was there, a thing they all know, with a kind of sixth sense, is there. The flexing, morphing green and red of the auroras, which snake around the inside of the atmosphere, fretful and magnificent like something trapped. "Nell," he says, "come, quick."
Samantha Harvey's Orbital is available commercially and is available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and braille. And Samantha, thank you so much.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
Sam will be back at the end of the show with some book recommendations, but now let's take our second visit to the RNIB Library.
New in the library is Shy Creatures by the award-winning Claire Chambers. It was given to us by W&N from the Hachette Publishing Group.
On Friday, she had been preparing the art therapy room for her favourite group of the week, male alcoholics, when Gil put his head around the door. Seeing that she was alone, he came in and sat on the corner of her desk, watching as she laid out paper, pencils, charcoal, and paints. A semicircle of easels was arranged around a still life, a wicker chair, draped in velvet cloth, beside a table on which sat a vase of tulips, a milk jug, and a bowl of eggs. The doors to the two small side rooms, used by patients who preferred to work in privacy, were half open, and he sent a glance of inquiry in their direction, which Helen answered with a reassuring shake of the head before he spoke.
In all failed relationships, there is a point that passes unnoticed at the time, which can be later identified as the beginning of the decline. For Helen, it was the weekend that the hidden man came to Westbury Park. Croydon, 1964. Helen Hansford is in her 30s and an art therapist in a psychiatric hospital where she's been having a long love affair with Gil, a charismatic married doctor. One spring afternoon, they receive a call about a disturbance from a derelict house not far from Helen's home. A 37-year-old man called William Tapping, with a beard down to his waist, has been discovered along with his elderly aunt. It is clear he's been shut up in the house for decades, but when it emerges that William is a talented artist, Helen is determined to discover his stories. Shy Creatures is a life-affirming novel about all the different ways we can be confined, how ordinary lives are built of delicate layers of experience, the joy of freedom, and the transformative power of kindness.
Kath is going down to Deal for the weekend with the children. Really? There had been false alarms of this nature before, and Helen had learnt not to give in to optimism too far in advance. He nodded. Her goddaughter has just had a baby, and she's going down there tomorrow to do whatever it is women do on these occasions. So... He stared at her with that burning look that he turned quite unconsciously on women of all ages, and his patients, both male and female. Helen had seen this phenomenon at work, but she liked to imagine that it contained a little extra intensity when it was directed at her. "You could stay at mine," she ventured. Even though they had been lovers for 3 years, and he had found her a suitable flat and contributed to her rent with just this kind of opportunity in mind, it had been possible no more than half a dozen times. "If you'll have me." "Well, I suppose, if you don't make a nuisance of yourself."
Shy Creatures by Claire Chambers is read by Lucy Scott, and it lasts 11 hours, 49 minutes.
For lovers of history, we have The Scapegoat by Lucy Hughes Hallett, which was donated by HarperCollins.
He was called a devil, a spotted monster, a comet that disrupted the natural order, scrambled social hierarchy, and set the music of the spheres a jangle. He was accused of being a traitor to his country, an enemy of the people, and a regicide who poisoned the king who loved him. To royalists, he was the vulgar upstart who dragged the monarchy into disrepute and weakened it fatally. To Puritans and Republicans, he was the epitome of all the vices endemic at the degenerate court of the earliest Stuart kings. He was arrogant. He was greedy. His lust was insatiable.
As King James I's favourite, Buckingham was also his confidant, gatekeeper, right-hand man, and lover. When Charles I succeeded his father, he was similarly enthralled and made Buckingham his best friend and mentor. A dazzling figure on horseback and a skillful player of the political game, Buckingham rapidly transformed the influence his beauty gave him into immense wealth and power. He became one of the most flamboyant and enigmatic Englishmen at the heart of 17th century royal and political life. Lucy Hughes Hallett transports us into the courtly world of masks and dancing, exquisite clothes, the art of Rubens and Van Dyck, gender fluidity, same-sex desire, and appallingly rudimentary medicine. Falling from grace spectacularly, Buckingham came to represent everything that was wrong with the country, From kidnappings and murder plots to men weeping in Parliament over civil liberties, The Scapegoat navigates love, war fever and pacifism in a society on the brink of cataclysmic change. In this immersive and authoritative account, Hughes Hallett summons an era that still resonates today.
Yet here are the words with which those who knew him well described him: modest, courteous, kind, obliging, affectionate, generous, gracious, loving, and again, this is the word that recurs most insistently, modest. By all reliable accounts, George Villiers, the Duke of Buckingham, was really very nice. His beauty was extraordinary. Even those who hated him, and by the time of his death they were legion, never denied it. He was called the handsomest-bodied man in Europe and one of the handsomest men in the whole world. Three monarchs loved him. King James I of England, 6th of Scotland, addressed him as sweetheart, or as my sweet child and wife, shared his bed with him, and told him that he would rather die than live without him. King Charles I worshipped him as a nervous adolescent worships an older and infinitely more glamorous brother. The Queen of France, Anne of Austria, told a confidant that if it were possible for an honest wife to love anyone other than her husband, then Buckingham would be the man she chose. Many of her contemporaries believed that, honest or not, she had an affair with him.
The Scapegoat, the brilliant brief life of the Duke of Buckingham, is written and read by Lucy Hughes Hallett and runs for 25 hours and 43 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The very first books in the studios were recorded on wax disc.
Of course, recording on wax discs means that you have to have a one take, basically. If you make a mistake during that recording, the whole disc is just wiped clean. So you have these narrators we had then had to record for about 25 minutes without making a mistake, and they were really adept at covering over mistakes, apparently. I remember one of our narrators called Andrew Timothy, he used to talk to us about recording on wax discs, and he was very clear about what he has to do. If he made a mistake, he didn't actually make a mistake, he just sort of covered it over and carried on recording. And one of his favourite things he used to say is that the important thing is you say a word that you've never heard of before, say it with such conviction that people who have been saying it correctly for the last 20 years are now wondering whether they are saying it correctly.
Quickly and with confidence.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally on today's show, a return to Booker winner Samantha Harvey for the books of her life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Gosh, there are loads. It's hard to narrow it down. If I've been asked this before, I've mentioned Danny the Champion of the World, which certainly was one of the books that I remember reading on my own and absolutely loving. Another was Goodnight, Mr. Tom, which I remember reading sort of on my own and being devastated. It's a very sad book, being really devastated by it, but also understanding at some level the the incredible power of reading. So probably those two would be my pick.
Yes, said Tom bluntly on opening the front door. What do you want? A harassed, middle-aged woman in a green coat and felt hat stood on his step. She glanced at the armband on her sleeve. She gave him an awkward smile. I'm the billeting officer for this area, she began. Oh, yes? And what's that got to do with me? She flushed slightly. Well, Mr. Oakley. Thomas Oakley. Ah, thank you, Mr. Oakley. She paused and took a deep breath. Mr. Oakley, with the declaration of war imminent... Tom waved his hand. I know all that. Get to the point. What do you want? He noticed a small boy at her side. It's him I've come about, she said. I'm on my way to your village hall with the others. What others? She stepped to one side. Behind the large iron gate, which stood at the end of the graveyard, were a small group of children. Many of them were filthy and very poorly clad. Only a handful had a blazer or coat. They all looked bewildered and exhausted. One tiny dark-haired girl in the front was hanging firmly onto a new teddy bear. The woman touched the boy at her side and pushed him forward. There's no need to tell me, said Tom. It's obligatory, and it's for the war effort. You are entitled to choose your child, I know, began the woman apologetically. Tom gave a snort. But, she continued, his mother wants him to be with someone who's religious or near a church. She was quite adamant. Said she would only let him be evacuated if he was. Was what? Asked Tom impatiently. Near a church.
That's Christopher Saul, reading from Goodnight, Mr. Tom by Michelle McGorian. Available from RNIB Talking Books, as is Roald Dahl's Danny, Champion of the World. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Well, there are loads, but in terms of sort of comfort reading, I really like the Winston Graham Poldark books. I first read them when I was in my early teens, and there are lots of them, maybe at least 12. It's just brilliant historical fiction, Hardy-esque at times. He writes so beautifully. And so I have been working my way very slowly through the series again. I think I'm on book number 7 or 8 at the moment. So those are books that I really like to come back to.
Joshua Poldark died in March 1783. In February of that year, feeling that his tenure was becoming short, he sent for his brother from Trenwith. Charles came lolloping over on his great roan horse one cold grey afternoon, and Prudy Painter, lank-haired and dark-faced and fat, showed him straight into the bedroom where Joshua lay posed up with pillows and cushions in the big box bed. Charles looked askance round the room with his small watery blue eyes at the disorder and the dirt, then lifted his coat-tails and subsided upon a wicker chair which creaked under his weight.
"Well, Joshua. Well, Charles. This is a bad business. Bad indeed. When will you be about again, do you think? There's no telling. I fancy the churchyard will have a strong pull."
Charles thrust out his bottom lip. He would have discounted the remark if he had not had word to the contrary. He hiccuped a little. Riding always gave him indigestion these days, and was heartily reassuring.
"Nonsense, man. The gout in the legs never killed nobody. It's when it gets up to the head that it's dangerous. Choke tells me different, that there is other cause for the swelling. For once, I misdoubt if the old fool is not right. Though in God's truth, by all appearance, 'tis you that should be lying here, since I'm but half your size."
Stephen Jack, reading from Ross Poldark, a novel of Cornwall by Winston Graham, the first in the Poldark series, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but some you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend?
Yeah, I would probably recommend The Friend by Sigrid Nunes. I read it about a month ago. It's partly about a woman's relationship with a dog she inherits from a friend who's died. And it's a very beautiful book about that relationship, but also her relationship with her friend who's passed away. So maybe because I'm in a doggy sort of dog frame of mind at the moment, it spoke to me. But it's a really wonderful, strange, unconventional, beautiful, moving book.
There were two errors in your obituary. The date you moved from London to New York, off by 1 year. Misspelling of the maiden name of wife one. Small errors, which were later corrected, but which we all knew would have annoyed the hell out of you. But at your memorial, I overheard something that would have amused you. I wish I could pray. What's stopping you? He is. Would have. The dead dwell in the conditional, tense of the unreal. But there is also the extraordinary sense that you have become omniscient, that nothing we do or think or feel can be kept from you. The extraordinary sense that you are reading these words, that you know what they'll say even before I write them.
That's Hilary Huber reading from The Friend by Sigrid Nunes, available commercially now. And once again, Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert. It's my pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and almost 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.